Welcome to the Backend Engineering Show with your host, Hussein Nasser. This is the show where we discuss the art and the craft of building software and cover recent news on backend technologies. If you enjoy the show, make sure to subscribe to the YouTube channel and rate it on Spotify and Apple Podcast. With that said, let's get on the show. Welcome to the Backend Engineering Show live. How are you guys doing? It's fine Saturday. How are you guys doing? How is everybody doing? Let's get this show started. It's 7 a.m. in the morning here in California. Very cold. Wrong scene. Chat. Yo, Tariq. What is going on, everybody? How's everybody doing this fine morning? Jeez, we're starting out with tough questions already. Sir, what is the use of a strategy proxy and how does it work? Never heard of a strategy proxy. Is that proxy that uses the strategy design pattern? I need to touch on that. What up, CB? What is everybody doing? How is everybody doing? John, how do you scale to like 5 million per minute for a spike every now and then? A right heavy app. I like these kind of questions where it's very specific, right? Because you can't just say, hey, I want to scale to 700 million requests, right? What does that mean, right? Is it reads? Is it like light reads? Is it OLAP reads, right? Analytical reads? Because a read could be a query that take 2 milliseconds to execute, but also a read could also mean an analytical report for a query on a billion row table that has to take a minute to execute. So balancing those requirements so you know, have, let's say, consistent and deterministic. That's the word I'm looking for. Deterministic. Predictable, right? Results. You need to segregate as much as possible. If you're saying I want to scale my application to million users, we have to ask the question, who are your users? What is your application? I know this, obviously we cannot do this live show, but we can tease apart what does that mean. And based on that, you can definitely scale your application. For the right load, again, we ask this question. Ooh, catching my breath, guys. Sorry. I was like running out down the stairs with my dog playing early. I know, I'm an early riser. So yeah, so the right loads usually depends on the application that does a write to a database, right? And you can scale that in so many ways, right? First of all, what does your app do when it writes to the database? Is it a simple row insert or is it a transactional multi-table writes, essentially? We're touching multiple tables. Not just that, we're actually processing, we're reading and writing at the same time to perform that write, right? Because you can just append a row to the table and that's fastest thing possible. you have that row, you can append it to the table. Even if that table has a trillion row, that insert always consistent and always fast. We know that. There are some limitations, some, let's say, side effects based on the database you use that might change that behavior. Let's say inserting that row must update multiple indexes because you have a lot of indexes in this row, right? And if those indexes are in general large in size because you have a large table, then the time it takes to update those indexes will suffer as a result. And this now comes down to the type of the index itself, right? That's why people prefer, like, I take that back. B trees versus LSM trees, right? B tree is a type of a data structure, and you can store in your index, and then the values that you insert will be balanced on that tree, essentially. So if you insert the value of 7, we'll look at the root, says, okay, the root is 10. 7 should always go to the left. The new value is, let's say, 11, then should go to the right, right? And start balancing this tree, right? You'll reach a point in your B tree structure where it has to be rebalanced, because otherwise everything will go this way, right? So by triggering a rebalance of the tree, some nodes will become root and everything will shift essentially. And that rebalancing is what causes an update. So you're doing an insert, which is fast, but that triggered an update to the index, right? Because we need to update that index, which is usually, if you're lucky, it's always an insert to the leaf node. But if that leaf node that you inserted in your index happened to be triggering that rebalance, then that whole index will need to update itself to the new structure, and that causes an update, right, to a specific location in disk, right? SSDs do not like that. SSDs do not like to go to a specific seeking to a specific place and writing to the same location. It loves to insert new stuff, right? If you're inserting new stuff, go for it. Updates, whether updates to the database itself or to the index, they don't like that. If you're doing so many rebalancing to this tree, then you start shaking. The SSD lifetime will deteriorate with time. I'm talking about Facebook now. And Google scale. I'm not talking about Jenny's donut shop, right? That she has a website with MySQL, right? I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about huge ass scale. Sweet. So that's why Google invented something called the LSM, the log structure merge tree, as an index structure to avoid this there is a rebalance still, but the tree is rebalancing itself by inserting always a new row. This always merges the logs and always inserts new stuff. It never updates existing structures because we SSDs for the solid state drives, we try to avoid updates as much as possible. That's the trick. So the right heavy question, it took us a long time to answer, but the ugliest answer that I could give, and I hate that answer, is really it depends. Thing, your content is real treasure. Thank you, Singh. Hello from Jerusalem, Adim. Thank you, Adim. Adim says hi. Because I don't know how to translate that. Maybe God bless you, I guess. That's the closest one. God gives you health. Raj, need some advice. I am working as a full stack developer, but most of my work assigned to me as a front end. That is the nature of a full stack developer. Companies, especially new companies, will hire for a full stack developer so they can switch you over to any whatever they have work, right? Say if they have work from the front end, they don't want to hire a dedicated front end engineer or the dedicated back end engineer or dedicated infrastructure engineer. They hire just a full stack engineer. So you can fit everywhere. So take this as a good opportunity, in my opinion. And yeah, today they have front end work, so that's why they assign you a front end work. But that does not mean you're stuck. So that's another advice I tell people. One of the things that employers do not like or pick upon, and we interview, I do a lot of interviews yearly, right? And what the things that we look for in an interview, maybe I shouldn't supposed to say that, but sure, let's say that. I guess it's public knowledge now. What we look for a candidate is, and we ask questions to kind of extract that without you knowing, but this is the gist of it. If you're, we ask you a question to detect and find out whether you are the kind of a guy or a gal that waits for instructions to execute certain tasks versus you actually digging up work and finding ways to improve the company, right? And that's, I see this a pattern, especially for junior people who just started, right? It's like they're waiting for some, hey, tell us what to do, right? And that's not bad necessarily. What I want engineers to switch from this state where they are given what to do to actually finding problems in the company. Because why would company hire you? A company would hire you because it knows it has certain limitation, right? And that limitation, they need smart engineers to identify those limitations so that they can essentially fix them, identify them, and improve the company as a whole, right? Because if the company know what it wants, it will hire for specific roles and say, okay, just do this thing, right? Otherwise, our jobs as engineers will be automated for the future, right? Our will be already automated. We are there for creative. We are not different as engineers. We are no different than artists, musicians, painters, poets. I put us in the same category as engineers. And this might come as a shock to some of you because I look at my art as engineering, as an art. It's art. I've been saying this since 2008. I always say that, and some people make fun of me. Says that, no, this is a job. I mean, yeah, maybe if you don't have the soul for it, if you don't feel it, then maybe that's right. But always, so back to Raj's question, Raj says, hey, I am full stack engineer, but all I've been assigned is front end. Don't let that stop you. You should have access to the code in the back end. If you're in the front end, that's the best way to become a good backend engineer is to be a front-end engineer, in my opinion, right? Because you are the number one consumer of the backend. You're the number one consumer of the backend. So you know the requirements, you know the bottleneck, and if you just step out of that shell that you have as a front-end engineer, which you have a lot of work, don't get me wrong, front-end engineers, there's so much stuff you guys do in the front-end. Whether this is web or mobile, but once you step that into a client-server architecture where you're making calls to a backend, then you think about it, you are the main consumer to the backend. You can improve it. You can identify the flaws and go back to your manager or boss or lead and say, yo, lead, what up? This is what I saw. I saw that your backend sucks, man. Your backing sucks. Your videos are funnier at 2x. I know some other people say I speak slowly, but I disagree. I try to stay calm. I know you guys, younger folks like to everything like fast and stuff, but I'm a boomer. Not really. A million. Do you like garlic? Jeez, okay. We're going there. All right, I love garlic. My favorite garlic sauce is that Papa John's sauce, the Papa John's. And you can dip it in everything and it will taste delicious. I love garlic. Put garlic in everything. I put garlic in ice cream. Kidding. But I saw an ice cream with garlic. Loads of love from Pakistan. All the love out of Pakistan. You are a great teacher. Thank you, Adolf. Hemant Kumar says, "Hi, Hussein. Can you please talk a little about distributed tracing? Why is it being discussed a little more now? Why is it not there earlier?" Here's the thing. There's something called hype, a lot of hype, right? And we always see this hype in technology, whether this is a valid hype or overhyped, right? It's a hype nevertheless, right? So the idea of having distributed tracing has emerged as a result of microservices, right? Here's the thing, guys. And I'm not saying that the use case is not valid. I'm just saying that here's the thing. We had, for the longest time, we had one application. I'm talking about the backend here. And components of this monolithic application were represented as libraries, right? Whether DLLs or other kind of libraries. And those components talk to each other by dynamically linking at runtime. So that means I have a Microsoft experience with C Sharp. You build a library as a DLL file, dynamic link library, and then you reference it in your application as a library. And then all of a sudden you have access to methods in this library, and you can call methods in that library. And all of that is done in the same operating system, in the same... What am I doing? What is this? I don't know what's this. Right. All what you're doing is basically you're calling that method, right? That call is in the same operating system, it's the same machine, right? So if you want to set logging, that's easy, right? Because you can, if you want to debug something, you step in, you add a breakpoint, and then you just follow the breakpoint. And if that breakpoint, if the method jump to the other library, that's fine because you link it in your code. And as long as you brought the symbols with you, you can jump to the other library and then start debugging the method. You can jump in like in and out easily, right? That's how you debug different application. But so the debugging was easier, I guess, until we decided to break down these monolith into smaller components that work across the network, right? So now if my library is now across the network that executes my work, now I have to open a connection, whether this is regardless of the protocol, RPC or on top of TCP or gRPC, regardless, right? I am about to send a request or to execute that method. Now it goes through the wire. How the heck are you going to debug that? It's a different machine. It's a different service. You're no longer able to debug the application as a whole. That's a flaw in the microservice architecture. In a nutshell, distributed tracing came in to track a single request across these different microservices to essentially debug them, not just during development, but even afterwards. Now, what exactly happened afterwards? I mean, for the longest time in a monolith, you have logs, right? You can just write to disk or write to that log to a disk or a shared drive or somewhere, an event, and in that machine, you'll go to that machine and you see the logs very clearly, right? It's like, here's what happened, because it's in the same machine. You clearly know what happened. And there are tools, obviously, to write these logs in a distributed manner in a centralized database so you can read the logs, right? Centralized manner. Right, that distributed tracing essentially tags every request with a unique ID that can be traced across all the services. Hope that helps. So that's distributed tracing. So it's a valid use case, but only if you have microservices, in my opinion. So that's the slippery slope that people run into, right? People get hyped because, oh, there's this shiny thing that's called microservices. Let me jump into it. And they don't know, oh, it's not, all of a sudden my applications are so tiny and clean. They throw this word a lot, cleaner, right? Now, cleany, all this clean stuff that you did, all of a sudden becomes dirty because you had to add a service mesh to track your stuff. You have to add a central data plane so these services can authenticate itself. Oh, this service cannot call this service because it's a shady service. All of a sudden, because you have networking, you have to authenticate this stuff. You have to secure, because some people might sniff in the middle. You don't have any of these problems in a monolith. Nobody can sneak into your memory and read method call, right? Unless you have a buffer overflow. But sometimes, man, sometimes I think we just overcomplicate our stuff. Again, if everything is managed for us as engineers, that's great. But that's back to me. I like to understand everything. Using ORM or running raw queries? Baron asks. Oh, I think you know what I'm going to answer, right? I don't like to use libraries that does the stuff that I already know how to do, right? Especially if this library is trying to be smart as too clever by half, right? ORMs, object relation and models, try to do so much stuff and simplify stuff. However, that is a slippery slope, and I try to warn people about this stuff. A lot of people use stuff to simplify their workflows, but as a result, I don't like to say this, but we produce very weak engineering, right? Because now, you just slap tools together. Now, what is the difference between you and a robot that can do? Because if I have a robot or an AI can just slam these tools together, right? The power of a true, real engineer is to understand the underlying technology behind all of this stuff. That makes you invaluable. Nobody can get rid of you as a result. You become really adept of how these things work. So I personally like to use raw queries because I'm going to configure my queries and indexes and all that stuff so that it performs the best to my use case. Again, not saying ORMs are bad. There are use cases to use these tools as long as you have the underlying knowledge of how this stuff works. I say the same thing about React. I say the same thing about ORM. I say the same thing about Socket.io. Use these tools, but do not, I repeat, do not use these tools if you do not know how it works. Should I learn microservices? Yeah, it's a very popular thing, and it's not. Here's the thing, guys. I'm not saying do not learn. Of course, you have to learn. You can learn anything. It's anything you're learning. You're not. No time is wasted because you're gonna gain knowledge that essentially adds to your belt, right? I don't know, guys, if you agree with that statement or not, but that's essentially my opinion. A lot of people say, hey, no, I just, in this case, I just use a language and it does everything for me. Why should I know how it works, right? And the people who argue with me and says like, oh, in this case, just go and program an assembly. right? Like, they're taking it so far, you know, it's just in the ridiculous levels. Like, yeah, of course I'm going to code in C and C plus a higher level language, right? And yeah, true, I do not understand how assembly works technically, but maybe I should, right? As a CPU in general, how does this language work in this CPU versus this CPU, right? This is a knowledge that I'm lacking, but I admit that I'm lacking. So if I'm using JavaScript, I absolutely know how JavaScript works, right? I know it's a single threaded. I know it does asynchronous jobs. I know the event model. And I know if I pick it on top of C sharp, I know what I put myself into. So a language that sits on top of JavaScript does not make sense to me, such as TypeScript, right? Why? Oh, yeah, I picked JavaScript because I don't want, I settled for a dynamically typed language and a single threaded language, and I'm happy with that decision that I made. Now, a lot of people pick TypeScript that redoes exactly what JavaScript was born to do. It was simple language. We added static typing on top of it. Well, why don't you just program in C++ and C sharp? Because that was the language. We moved to a dynamic because we want a simpler way and we designed it to do certain things. I understand JavaScript evolves, the language evolves. Obviously, you have to build, and TypeScript is popular, but again, that's just an unpopular opinion from me. And again, TypeScript is being used in my company, and I try to have this argument with people, but I've been shut down all the time. Obviously, because at the end, yes, TypeScript definitely is way better than JavaScript, right? But if you know JavaScript, then why? What value does TypeScript give you other than static analysis? I heard that people are with problems all the time with TypeScript. So you just added another layer of complexity. That's what I don't like. Adding ORM, we're talking about ORM and raw queries for those who are listening, watching. Talking about ORM and then raw queries, and I said, oh, I don't like to use a higher level if I understand how to use the bare metal, right? And we talked about the JavaScript, the same thing, right? JavaScript and TypeScript almost fits the same thing in my opinion, right? That's why people are moving to WASM and WebAssembly in this case. But yeah, because you can't run C++ on the web, well, you can, right? With the WebAssembly now. WebAssembly, you can compile your C++ as a WASM, then run it there, right? So yeah, you're right, Chris, right? Chris has a good point. Right? So like, oh yeah, I couldn't write C++. We needed something and we need that. So it's always like a race. Where are we trying to go? And again, guys, anything I say obviously could be wrong. It's a personal opinion, personal preface. Don't need to take it personally or anything like that, right? It's just we're discussing, we're having a discussion as a backend engineer. I might be wrong, and I've been wrong so many times in this channel, and you guys called me out on it, so I'd love to learn. So the invention of TypeScript in 2012, where WASM was not invented, right? Back then, I believe. Right? So TypeScript, Microsoft saw a need for the JavaScript flaws, right? Which is the static analysis and problems people run. So they invented TypeScript, right? Which sits on top of JavaScript. And now it uses JavaScript, compiles down to JavaScript, and it solves a lot of problem, and people are happy, and you saw the rise of TypeScript, right? That just blew up. Same thing with JavaScript in mid-2000, right? So now WASM came in and actually solved the main problem that TypeScript solved. So I don't know if TypeScript will live. Maybe it will just, there will be an inertia, a technological inertia that will keep it alive. But it's a good language. It's great. Yeah, that's that. Let's leave it at that with TypeScript. Rails. I have not programmed for Rails at all, but I know Twitter runs on Rails. TypeScript have a huge advantage of making working in team much simpler, 100%. Yes, I agree with you, Emil. Elixir, that's what WhatsApp is on. No, it's Erlang, sorry. Erlang is, WhatsApp is written on Erlang. Erlang, we talked about that a little bit, right, guys? It's really good. It's a really good language. The ability to replace code in runtime, it's really popular. All right, we have. How are you guys doing? Do you like the show? If you like the show, hit that like button and subscribe. Make sure to subscribe so you don't miss this stuff. We do this live streams weekly, Saturdays, 7 a.m. PST, very early here in California, very cold too. Anil asks, can you talk about stored SQL stored procedure, please? So a database can be queried in multiple ways. The first way is to establish a connection from a client that understands how to speak the database language, and that language is basically not necessarily the SQL, SQL. It is the protocol itself, which is the TCP on top of TCP, right? Whatever that protocol is used. So if you have a client that understands how to make this communication with the database, then you can communicate with that and then send a query to execute a stateless, almost a stateless query, right? And then return a result. The other way is to make that stateful and start the transaction, right? And then execute multiple queries and then commit or roll back if this the things went wrong, right? That's a stateful transactional query. And then you can roll back. And the third approach is to create what is called a database cursor. So the cursor exists on the database. You say, hey, execute this query, but don't give me the results. Just create a cursor and let cursor. My God, English is hard. And my accent is thick, so excuse me, guys, as I navigate in anglais, as I navigate ego ga difficile. I just mixed French and my God. So the third approach is the client executes a query and tells the database to create a cursor. That means it just sits as a server-side cursor, essentially, right? That sits on the database and then waits for instructions from the client to fetch the result. You might have seen this in the when you do a trace analysis, right? You're saying, okay, execute, and there is a fetch. Fetch actually tells the cursor to go and prepare and pull the rows from the heap and then give it back, essentially, right? And it's very popular for paging, right? When you want, like, you don't want the database to actually bring all this 100 million rows, right, to the client. And I'm talking about the client. Here is the backend, right? Backend, which makes the queries. You don't want the client to make all these queries and bring it to the backend, and then the backend just processes all this junk, right? So you want to tease apart that stuff. Cursors are great. The final thing is the question Anil asked is a stored procedure where you compile the query in the database itself instead of sending it across the wire. And you, as a client, say, hey, database, there is a stored procedure or a function called test. Please execute that. That's it. That's what you say. And you give it some parameters optionally. The database will go and say, okay, there's the query, and then execute the query and it'll return the result. The advantage of that is the client no longer need to worry about the query itself. So if the query changes, you go to the database and change it, and all of the clients sees the thing. Guys, we'll be back in a minute. My dog is crying for some reason. I need to see what's wrong with him. We'll be right back after this short break. Stay tuned. All right, we are back. Back this. We are back. Back desu ka? Did you ever use Rusto? I have not. It's my on my list of languages to try. Just there's no much time to do anything. Like I look at certain amount of hours for this channel, and that includes learning, the studying, researching, talking about news. That is just essentially takes time. So, and to me, if I know how to program in a language, I don't see value in learning new languages unless it gives me huge, huge advantage, right? So, especially at my age, right? There is no requirement for me to learn a language because I can pick any language in a week, right? As a syntax. And then it takes time to understand the intricacies of that language itself. I see Lenny and Otto is answering questions. That's good. Mayanak Ul asks, how to extract millions of rows from a database without putting loads in it? I tried batching, but the thought of running a query in loop sickens me. There must be a better approach to this. So you'll ask yourself, extracting millions of rows from a database. If this is a one-time thing, and I God hope to God this is a one-time thing, because that doesn't make any sense if it's something that you're doing daily, right? Because I don't know why would you do this daily, extracting millions of. But if you are doing this on certain batches, right, and it's a one-time event, you get, then it doesn't matter, right? There is no other way to extract or transform this data other than querying it, right, and slowly paging this millions of rows and putting in another row, another database. Because that, think about how else would you do it, right? Again, you have to tease apart what is the purpose of this. Usually, normal application don't process millions of rows out of the thin air, right? There is a reason for that. And if you try to avoid that, that's the best approach. But if you want to do an ETL, and that's a tool that you build and you run it and it takes days and that's it, you're done. We know it's going to take a long time. The other approach is to speed up that process by doing parallel execution, right? So, okay, of course, one client reading from this database is going to take time, so I'm going to spin up multiple clients and divide the work. And there are tools that do that. How to get better with SQL and schema design in Postgres? Varun asks, how to get better and design SQL with Postgres? Well, Postgres is a beast. I mean, I've been using Postgres for not as much as other databases, but for, I would say, 6 years maybe. And I still, to this day, I'm learning new things with Postgres. It's just a big database. So that continuous thing, so you have to put in your mind that the learning will be continuous, right? You're not going to stop learning about Postgres because there is no, it's being developed on a daily basis. People maintaining the Postgres project are adding stuff to that project every single day, right? So it's going to take time. The second approach to help learn this is to actually have use cases. And I tried, guys, I tried this. You cannot learn a project without a use case. It's very, very hard. You can't say, hey, I studied Postgres by reading the doc. Doesn't work. The only way to learn Postgres or any database or any technology for that matter is actually to put it in test. And how do you put it in test? You have no idea. You have to work for someone or company, then that company will have use cases, and based on what you read, you say, oh, Postgres might help for this because there's something called this. You start putting two and two together and you start implementing that use case into the technology itself, which is the Postgres, right? And then once you start implementing, you run into all sorts of trouble because you have in your mind, you want to do something, right? And if Postgres or any technology might bend with your will, or it might not. It was just like, hey, there is this limit. Oh, you cannot do this because of this. You cannot do this because of this. You'll start doing this. But if you just say, hey, I'm going to try out Postgres, and you just, I don't know, you do a hello world or query execution, or even replication for that matter, if you don't have a use case behind it, it just, you will just do the tutorial, just do, you do the first thing that comes to your mind, and then you're going to stop. It says, yeah, okay, I did replication. But the use case drives the technology, and the technology will morph based on the use case or the requirement. So yeah, find a try from the company itself to find these use cases. Very, very. Do you know a good resource for learning Postgres? The doc is the best resource. And there's a blog called Use the Index. Luke, I believe. This guy, man, he's the god indexing and stuff like that. Tips on partitioning MySQL table. Ooh, okay, I think I made a video about that. Might be a members only. It's in my database engineering Udemy course. But essentially, partitioning is one of the very interesting things that you do in a database, and it gives you a lot of performance benefits for large tables, and all it's almost for free, right? Because the way the client is interacting with this partition is agnostic. It doesn't know that the client who is executing the query doesn't know about partitions. It'll just query the table. And the database knows about this partition and will just query, split that. So in that video, I talked about the best practices of doing that. You split that, what kind of queries, right? Some queries, because it becomes multiple tables, right? So multiple tables mean multiple places, means multiple queries technically. So more work, more indexes. Think about all that stuff. Not. It comes back to all that discussion where you should really know what you're using, right? Just using partitions and you know, oh, this is partitioning. It breaks down tables, and if you have a large table, it breaks it into multiple tables. But what's the implication for that? If you understand how this works and you execute a query that is terrible, could be actually slower and partitioned than the monolithic table because your query happened to inefficiently scanning all the partitions anyway. Because what makes partitioning good? The idea of partitioning is you execute a query, and from the query we detect a key that hints to which partition, to hints the database to access the partition that it actually need and not everything. And once it gets that hint, it will efficiently hit that partition, and that partition is always smaller. So the query is always going to be faster, okay? But if that key is missing, or there are additional predicates that exist in this query that kind of negate the idea of a key, I don't know, you're querying on something else, then the database will say, I don't know what to do. I mean, he's not querying on the key, so I gotta go scan all the partitions to find this dang thing that he's searching for. So, right. So new partition on a key. So the queries will only be efficient when you actually use that key. Postgres is smart enough. It knows sometimes that, yeah, I think it can derive from the query that even if there is other parameter, it knows that, like, for example, if it's an and, a key and something, that's beautiful. Because and means, well, if it's and, that means it has to have this key. So it's only this partition. Well, if it's or, this key or, I don't know, date of birth, which date of birth is not partition, then you just screwed yourself. Because or means, oh, I have to do this or this. I have no idea. This guy means he wants anything, right? So he's just like, or she wants anything. So he goes scanning all the partitions. Django with React. How the combinations? Don't know anything about those two. Sorry. I know a little bit of Django, but React, nothing. Which is the best certification according to you? Your prediction on the on industry in 2020. I know the cloud will get more and more popular. That's for sure. That's a good question. Predictions for 2021. I mean, it's hard to make predictions. Awesome. I mean, and try to make speculation, but I'm seeing the market of the cloud is increasing really rapidly. The idea of having databases in the cloud. The problem with databases in the cloud is, I mean, you've seen the news that I've been covering, right? All these Postgres instances that have been hijacked because they put it on public ports and make it available for everyone to query. That's the idea here becomes, the cloud made us really, like, made us really sloppy engineers, right? Like, we became sloppy with the cloud because a cloud naturally does a lot of stuff for us, right? And the nature of ease with the cloud kind of puts us in ease. Like, okay, oh, I can do all this stuff. But we don't understand that what work, how things actually work on premise, that we're going to put it on the cloud. We think we're good. No, there's still security risk in the cloud. So that's why engineers are paid more and more to be experts in what they do, not just deploy. You should know. I know what I preach here is not popular, right? A lot of people say, oh, use this and use this, everything beautiful, and use it and that, done. Use Netlify. Netlify is good. Build your application. Done. And for an end user, I might actually use Cloudflare to deploy my website. Why? Because I actually exactly understand how it works. Jamstack, all that jazz. I understand how they built it. And Netlify, the way I tried to Netlify a little bit, and I saw it's genius that how they did it. And if you think about it, the idea of deploying encryption, deploying a certificate immediately for you, it's genius, right? With the CNAME and how you can point your domain to their, essentially to their subdomain, and that all of a sudden you have a website very quickly. I spin up my website really quickly with Netlify, and Cloudflare came up with this feature. So if I want to save time to deploy a simple static website, I'm going to use this. I'm not going to write my whole stack from scratch, which kind of contradicts what I was saying. But what I'm building, I understand how it works. I understand the whole stack, right? So there is a flaw. I know what kind of things that Cloudflare is doing. I know by doing that, Cloudflare is actually copying, have full access to my content and copying it across all the edges. If you ask people, people don't know that this is happening, by the way. Like, are you okay with Netlify copying your content? Some people say, oh, I didn't know that they were doing that. I was copying my GitHub. No, they have full access to your shit. Understand this stuff. Again, guys, understand how stuff works. We want that bug tour. A lot of people want the book tour. Oh my. Guys, these are books from 20 years ago. What do you want to see in them? All right, let's do a book tour.
This book.
This is one of my greatest books. It's called The Zen and the Art of Systems Analysis by Patrick McDormand. Right? And this book, my God, doesn't have technical stuff, right? But it changes your thinking to essentially make you connection with the work that you're putting for the system analysis with the design you're building. And if you have that connection with your work, you become essentially an artist and you appreciate everything that you see. So if I look at Cloudflare and I look at Netlify, I look at Kubernetes, and I see the art behind the work, and I really appreciate, I don't just use it, I absolutely appreciate these kind of things, right? This is a good book. I don't recommend you just buying it and just look it up on Amazon. I read books, weird books like this. I'll just, this is another book. This is a new book, and disclaimer, O'Reilly reached out to me to review this book. Full disclosure, they paid me to review this book, right? They're not paying me to view and share this book for you, right? They just paid me to review it, so my name is actually in the book as a viewer, right? This book really good. I'm not saying it just because I review it, because it took a couple of times, and I wrote a lengthy review for O'Reilly. If you're using Nginx, this book will give you a recipe. It's not going to teach you how Nginx work, let's be honest. It's going to teach you how to apply different methods to implement Nginx, whether it's a cloud, security, I forgot, so much stuff. They go through load balancing, how to deploy HTTP2, how to deploy it on a different operating system. And what I didn't like about the book, and of course I'm gonna say that, is a lot of examples are of them, the paid version, which is Nginx Plus, and I did criticize that as well, right? So they know about this, they're fine with that. But a lot of examples are, these examples that are being are Nginx Plus, not Nginx Free. So if you get the book and you don't have Nginx Plus, you might not take use for it unless you purchase that Nginx Plus. But so that's another kind of a thing. Obviously, O'Reilly is not paying me to promote this book or anything like that. I just merely reviewed it. Right, so that's I recommend that if you was in Nginx, this is a good book to have it by your side. So, okay, how do I do this? So it's like there is a lot of really, it just was released December 2020. This was just released, literally released. So check it out. And the author is absolutely sweetheart, Derek DeJonga. And the book name is Nginx Cookbook, Advanced Recipes for High Performance Load Balancing. What else would I share with you? Something other than this is my favorite book. Presentation Zen. I don't think this is the second book, Presentation Zen. So guys, Presentation Zen, this guy, Gar Reland, Presentations in. To how to present your ideas. And I think that part of this is what made me good presenting and talking. Obviously, I still suck, but I think I can improve. But this book showed me the skill set of how to present your idea in a very succinct manner and to get to the point immediately, to remove the clutter of stuff that you don't need to show. Because engineers, always us, like, we're always like, oh, I need to show this. I need to show this. I need to show them about this. I need to tell them about this. I need to tell them about all this stuff. Right? Another good book. You can see a pattern, right, guys? You can see a pattern. I'm into Zen in Japan and programming, stuff like that, and art. Right? So, the Zen of Programming, Jeffrey James. That's a lot. I love this book a lot. So, and there are some technical books there. There's some my own books. I wrote 4 books for you who don't know. I wrote 4 books on... 5 books actually, for mostly on my specialty is geographic information system. So all my books are about GIS, right? But in this channel, I never talk about GIS, so it doesn't conflict of interest with my current employer, which is Israel. So I don't talk about GIS at all. Design pattern, good stuff there. A Simple Language, that's my textbook from some of the stuff I never read. Like I read in 2001, and they are still there, right? Plus, you spent so much time with this sucker. UML Distilled 3rd Edition. It's not a good book, by the way. Martin Fowler, I'm sorry. This is not a good book. Right? I criticize Martin Fowler for this book. Or UML, right? Because I cried back in 2005 when I read this and I want to do my stinking UML, and he doesn't have enough examples. So I did not like this book, right? It's very distilled. There is no detailed that I wanted. Obviously, UML is not. What else, guys? What else? PHP, Steve Jobs, obviously. My Bleach collection, my video game. This is one, I don't know if you guys know Seth Godin. This guy is a marketeer, but this is one of the first books I read into. I started reading it. I recently started reading. So The Purple Cow, it's not an engineering book, but it will tell you how to make a product that stands out, right? So the idea of being remarkable, essentially. It's distilled on the front page. I know, right? Yeah, I guess I am too harsh on Martin. Martin, I like Martin. Martin Fowler is one of those technologists and computer scientists that says, okay, he called out Jason as a fashion choice. I remember that. And I kind of agree with him. Because he's like XML. That was like a long time presentation between XML and Jason. Like when people started moving to Jason, right? I was like, this is so fashion choice. And I had to agree with him. Like, because the parsing cost of Jason is not any better than XML. I mean, slightly better. But you think about it, XML is more readable, JSON. I guess. Then we came up with the YAML. Everything just screwed up. Stupid YAML. I hate YAML. Don't try to take. I will judge you. Like you. I will judge you. I'm kidding, obviously. My favorite Japanese artist, fighter, Sashi. I have his book right there. The Book of 5 Rings. Just makes you a little bit more zen and pip. Musashi is another book. Musashi, I don't know if you can see him. Yeah, you can see it. His biography or autobiography. No, it's biography. Design pattern. Part now, because of you guys. This book is the most book I ever read in my life. Back in 2004, 2005. God. Tim Ferriss fan? Yes, I like Tim Ferriss. 4 hours work week. Yeah. First, when I read that book, it's like it gives you the idea that, oh, you should never work hard. So I didn't really like it. But as once you read it, you actually understand. So Design Pattern, that's a summary of, and with full beautiful examples of the actual badass book, which I actually recommend. This book. Design Patterns. This is the Gang of Four. Eric Gamma, Rich Helm, Ralph Johnson, John. The scene design pattern, the essentially reusable object. So most of the object-oriented design patterns are these collected by those puppies. Those guys, they pull it in this book. But this is a dry read. This is a very dry read. That girl that has the design pattern head first, that's better for if you're starting with stuff. It uses Java and stuff like that. So yeah, Tim Ferriss, I like all that. I listen to all that stuff. And do you guys recommend in the chat what other books? Book that got me into what I'm doing right now, into software engineering. I read this when I was, I don't remember exactly, but I read this when I was maybe 16 years old. That's the first book I ever read about programming, and I implemented that. Learning, programming, and Visual Basic 2. I have this book. My uncle gave it to me when I was 16, and that's how I got into computer science. It changed my life, this book. So I first, obviously, I didn't have Visual Basic 2.0. I had Visual Basic 5, version 5. So there was a lot of changes, and this book was written on top of Windows 3.1, and I had Windows 95, I believe, back then. All right, guys, so I think that's enough with the book. I have to rearrange my library thanks to you. Love from India, Akshay. So there was like a good questions here. Lots of good questions. Would you kindly talk about backend and Android development? I don't think backend would differ whether you're using Android or iPhone, in my opinion. It's the same exact thing. There was a good question that I missed. Gurav, please answer. When to use HTTPS connection pooling and what are the use cases? So, connection pooling is a very important back-end feature. And I hope that it's going to die soon. And here's why. So with that said, let's explain what connection pooling is. Connection pooling, the idea of having a pool of connections that the client can use to send requests on each one of them. And the idea of that is because you cannot concurrently send multiple requests on the same TCP connection. That's the HTTP 1.1 design, and that's the TCP design. You cannot send logical requests in parallel in the same TCP connection because the server will has to figure out which request came out because they're going to assemble those packets into what request means, right? And the second packet, set of packets into the second request. And then it has to remember, I received this request first, so I have to respond with this request. And if I receive this request first, second request, I have to respond the second, right? So the orders start to matter. And boy, when you start implementing orders, when it comes to logical application, things break apart, right? And you get into things like head of line blocking and stuff like that. So what we said, okay, let's do connection pooling. And we do connection pooling in the front end with HTTP 1.1 in the browser. We open 6 TCP connections, and if we want to, like, let's say, retrieve a CSS file, an HTML file, a JavaScript file, and an MP4 file, we send 4 requests across 4 different connections, right? And I talked about that many times. Check out my HTTP playlist if you want to learn more. In the backend, when I receive a request and then wants to connect to a database, for example, right? Or any other things, right? I have the same problem. I cannot execute multiple requests on the same connection. So I end up either doing open a connection, send my request. If I receive another request, oh, this connection is busy. So let me open another connection, send that request. And if there is a third request, oh, let me open another request, and open another connection, send my request. That is slow. That is extremely slow. Why? Because you're taking the cost of the request itself to open a connection, something that is not part of the request itself, right? The request is asking you to process the result, right? To actually execute the query. But now you're taking time, extra time, to do this cold start kind of a thing, right? Starting up connections. That's bad. So what we do in the back end, we open 20, 30, whatever, connections to the database, right? I know your question was about HTTPS pooling, which is a little bit different, but it can be fitting with everything. But now we start opening these multiple connections. Obviously, they take memory, and they are very difficult to manage without a library. That's why some more library now take care of pooling, right? You take a connection from the pool, you execute your query, and then you return it to the pool, and then you work with this pooling, right? So that's the idea of connection pooling. The new protocols, such as HTTP2 on top of HTTPS, obviously, and QUIC, I think it deprecates the idea of connection pooling. We have not, theoretically speaking, I have not seen an implementation of connection pooling as these protocols, right? But I take that back. Actually, Envoy proxy, if you guys use it, uses HTTP2 on the backend to do the pooling. So it only have one connection. Check out my video on Envoy if you want to learn more. Just type Envoy Hussein. So the backend, they started using HTTP2, which is HTTPS, right? Because HTTP2 has to be secure for protocol ossification reasons. And then you can multiplex requests in the same TCP connection by identifying each request with a stream ID, right? And then these streams will be dedicated, and you can send this beautiful request, you get back a response, and each response will come into its own stream. So you can clearly identify which request belong to which response, and so on. Now you can easily multiplex. So HTTPS connection pooling, that's what I explained. And the goal here is to move databases and backends to start using the QUIC protocol or HTTP. I know database vendors do not like HTTP at all. So they probably going to use the QUIC protocol to establish this pooling mechanism. And I believe this is going to be a revolutionized technology if implemented right. So someone asked earlier, what do you expect in 2021? I think people start moving to QUIC a lot and HTTP3. And not necessarily explicitly moving, oh, I'm using QUIC, is going to happen without you knowing. And that's the beauty of HTTP, right? You're still using GET and POST, but the browsers internally just know. Just knows how to switch you. If the backend supports HTTP3, your client will automatically start using HTTP3 and QUIC. That's the beauty of using browsers as web applications, because you don't have to worry about client libraries like dedicated. Hope you guys are enjoying this backend engineering show so far. Hit that like button if you do. And bring in these good old great questions. This is great questions. Thank you. Roman says, thanks to you for your channel. I thought I was single, so interested in backend engineering. So he's saying, all right, I thought it was only on interested in back engineering. Yeah, I am interested in software engineering in general, but I have a specific interest in back end because that's what I work with in daily basis. So I thought I'll start making more videos on this topics because obviously there's a lot of demand for it. And welcome, guys, for the new subscribers. Guys, we're blowing up. This is insane. You know, guys, right? I never take anything for granted. When I see these numbers, look at this. We just hit 83,000 subscribers. I didn't even imagine when I had 10,000 subscribers, 10,000 people, 82,000 decided that this content is worth it. Let me say it again. 83,000 people. And it's increasing. It's the idea that I knew something and I kept it for myself for that long is so selfish. And this is kind of going to turn into some sort of a motivational speech. And I apologize for those who don't like this. But I think if you know something, right, if you have a specific skill set in a certain niche, it is selfish to keep that for yourself. I think you should share that knowledge with the intent that you want to have some people take advantage of this and help people. And I am blown away by the messages I receive every day that someone got a job because they watch a few videos of my channel, because they now understood the fundamentals, because that's what I lacked 10 years ago. And I realized that, and I says, oh shit, I don't understand how things work. And when someone, especially a great engineer, you interview with a great engineer, they tear you to apart, and happened to me. It tore me apart. So it's like, sorry, you don't understand how things work. They said it to my face. That was like 11 years ago. Like, no, you don't understand how things work. You're spoiled by the f and distracted by the shell of the technology, but you don't understand how things work. Because the moment he started pushing me, and I just fall apart because I didn't know understand. So I took it to myself to actually start understanding the fundamentals. And that, when I see these comments now, says, hey, I read this and I watched the TCP video, I watched YouTube, which we take for granted. We take the OSI model for granted as engineers. We say, hey, that's network engineering yucky stuff. No, man, you gotta understand this stuff. And it's not really that hard. And I try to take it from a perspective that is as a software engineer myself, and I start to explain it. When you do that, something magical happens. I feel like a Smurf. Magical happened. Magical! Welcome to Disneyland! But seriously, all seriously speaking, yeah, Google Incident. Yes, I'm working on it. Yes, Rohit. Thank you so much, guys, for sending me all these links. Yes, 100%. The Google Incident, I need to report on it. So, what we're saying? Yeah, thank you so much. So, I'll start. I'm reading the article. It's a little bit in the fatty side, which is, I don't know what's Arabic. It's called decima. It's very rich, rich. It's very rich. So I need to dissect it, read it, and start the detailed analysis with you. So, guys, if you have certain knowledge, go out there and share it with people. You have no idea how I started this channel because I know it's something called ArcObject, which is a very specific API in the geographic information system area for my company, which is Esri. And funny enough, they saw my video and they decided to hire me, right? And they saw my books as well. So they flew me away from Bahrain. They gave me a visa. They gave me everything. So I was like, come on, work with us. Because if you know the basics, if you know how things, if you wouldn't have no idea how sharing specific knowledge that you might know might help people. Just insane. So Be generous. And don't try to clickbait people or just show something and look at videos on YouTube and say, oh, this is getting 300 million views. Getting 300 million. I mean, they're like the top programming languages is getting all the views. So, and you don't see any one of my videos. I never make these videos because I don't see a point for it. There is no top programming languages at all. There's popularity, but I don't see a value of making a video like that just to make popular content. You know, when I see a value of making a video, I'll make a video. What I see on YouTube is like always the same content, right? Because that what gets views, and that frustrates me. So don't fall into that trap if you want to start your own channel, I think. And then, Jetin says, Arsene, I had to interview a couple of candidates today. I asked which I inspire. I asked question which inspired from your video. Oh, the video for the backend? Is that it? Thank you. That's good. I'm glad. So, I mean, definitely you can ask this question. And it's fascinating how many different answers you get. And there is no wrong or right answer, to my opinion. It's fascinating to how different answers you get, and you expand your knowledge this way. You will see, like I interviewed a girl the other day, my company, and I asked her the same question, and she mentioned something I never knew. There is a tool that you can install that does distributed tracing for you. And I was like, yeah, she's good. Obviously, when I pushed her, she didn't know how that tool works, which kind of I ducked her a point of that, but that doesn't mean anything, obviously. Doesn't mean she's not qualified, right? But the idea that she found a solution, it does not matter, right? She found a solution to my problem that I asked her, and that's what matters. And what else? Does blockchain had any use other than financial and security? I know very little about blockchain, and I try to criticize this technology, but I think I criticize it too immaturely, in my opinion. I think it's a big thing, but I think it's being abused, in my opinion, with Bitcoin and the way I see Bitcoin and all this. It just hurts my heart that all this compute that we do with mining is just wasted, right? It's just like a lot of people wasting electricity to spin up these mining, right, farms to mine something that is essentially become very valuable because the community decided. And this proof of work is we need something better than that, because that does not scale, right? It's like I think I heard, like last time I read, like Bitcoin was gonna expire, it's gonna deplete in 2140 year, right? And there was like, I think there was like only how many million Bitcoin left? Not much, right? So the difficulty of mining those Bitcoin will just exponentially increase. And my fear is people will go nuts and start pushing the technology to start mining. And as a result, we're gonna use more and more power. Just because more than 50-60% of the miners don't end up with anything, right? Because they spend a lot of power and they throw it out of the window, and that hurts the environment. I know I sound like a tree hugger now, but that just doesn't make sense to me. I mean, maybe I don't give money. Hey, Hasan, are you going to make a video on solar winds? Oh my God, the solar winds is insane, Sabine. Sabine Sayed, thank you so much. But definitely, I need to understand how that happened, because that is the genius behind solar wind problem, that the breach that happened, and the Orion patching, and the genius of the code written algorithmically generating domains that just every day, so that And that domain belonged to a subdomain that already is legitimate somehow. I don't know how they managed to do that. And the IP address belonged to, they pointed to an IP address which belonged to a VPN, which then in the same country that you are in, and that VPN point to the command center in Russia. Just so they can avoid the firewalls and the automatic detection systems. Because if you have a patch and you are in, I don't know, say Florida, and you're seeing pings going to Florida IP address, and the domain is also, that's okay, all good. You're not going to suspect anything. Oh, this is just pointing to an IP address project. So maybe there's an update. They want to do an update and patch. That's good. But what they did is they infected the software, this enterprise network management software, I think it's called Orion, and they infected it so it updates itself with the malware as a patch. So it requested a patch, and the patches are being requested from the command center, which is C2 instance on Russia. But the way they managed to detect that, they don't hard code the IP address. No, no. They don't hard code a domain. No, no. Right? They generate a subdomain, a CNAME, that is algorithmically generated every day. And the attacker will say, okay, today is what? Today is December 19th. So the algorithm is going to generate a domain that starts with ABC, cloud.domain.orion.com. So it's going to generate that domain. They're going to end an entry CNAME for that date, pointing to an IP address that points to an IP address. And just know, this is the domain for Florida, so we're going to point to the IP address in Florida. If you're in India, we're going to point to an IP address in India, VPN, and then that VPN will shovel us to the actual command center and gives us full control of all the device. And I'm going to talk about all of that stuff, but the reading, so much stuff. WJ, I am a mid-level engineer. I'm a new subscriber. You have a lot of videos. Where to start? A good question. I always have a lot of videos. I have over 500 videos. So don't feel overwhelmed. Don't feel that you have to finish all these videos today, right? Take your time. Start from the backend engineering beginner playlist. There is a beginner playlist called Backend Engineering Beginners. Watch that list, right? Because I start from the fundamentals. And that fundamentals will walk you through different topics, and you start asking questions, and I'll jump in to answer, and the people from the community will jump in to answer to help. And then that will form you quickly. As you start asking questions, you're like, now it makes sense. And you walk through the intermediate playlist, which is longer. Then you go to the advanced playlist. Then you start watching random videos like that. Again, this is going to take time, so take your time. Mshari says, "أحبك يا حسين." I love you too. Thank you, Mshari. What are your thoughts about Golang as a backend? Is it a future? Golang is a good language, Vishnu. Golang is a good language. I heard a good thing about it. I mean, the reason people invent a new language to solve certain problems in existing languages, as we evolve, a networking pattern is very important, right? And that does not exist built in most languages. Networking pattern where, I don't know, HTTP library, HTTP2 library, HTTP3 library. So Google, I believe, they built Go.
Is that right?
So that they focus on networking as a first principle. Right, so that is a very good choice to build backend application with Go, especially if this backend talks to other backends. Armin, Ehsen, loving your content. Keep up the great work. I have a backend coding challenge tomorrow for one company. What would you do one day before if you had to prepare for the challenge? It's a coding challenge. Oh my God. I mean, for the coding challenge, you're going to expect literally anything. I mean, I failed many coding challenges. So I'm not the best guy to ask this question, but I would basically not study at all, in my opinion. Because like, what are you gonna study that will give you an edge, right? To me, understanding the fundamentals of how backend works, how to establish an HTTP request, how to establish an HTTP 2, HTTP 3, how to spin up a quick server, how to spin up an HTTP server, that's the most stuff. I mean, that's the more important thing. And once you understand the fundamentals of these things, now you ask this question, okay, how can I build a backend? How can I spin up, for example, a proxy, and I configure the proxy? And maybe that's not the question you're gonna get, but these are the stuff that you get in the backend, right? I don't know if they're gonna ask algorithms. My God, tough luck with that, because you gotta start memorizing algorithms. Sheesh. I mean, how long is the coding challenge? That's another question. So yeah, best of luck. Let us know, how did you do? Is there a connection between RAM and TCP connection? A little bit. The TCP spins up something called a file descriptor, which takes a little bit tiny amount of RAM in memory. Not much, though. But HTTP takes a little bit more, right? Because especially HTTP 1, which is on top of TCP, so there is the memory of the TCP, there's a memory occupied by HTTP, because there's headers coming in, there's body comes, you have to put this body and content somewhere in memory. That takes some of your memory, right? And then you have to release it, stuff like that. So yeah, HTTP 2 takes a little bit more memory, and it takes a little bit more CPU as well. Because HTTP 2 now does more work when it comes to packet. When you just get packets with HTTP 1.1, you just you assemble the packet until you see a new line. Hey, that's the end of the request. Done. With HTTP 2, no. There are headers in HTTP 2 that you have to read. So you receive the TCP packets. Come on. Packets. And then you say, oh, wait a second. What's this? Oh, this is the end of stream one. Okay, there's a header. Then you start making sense of this header. And then, oh, this is just packet of stream one. So you have to wait for more stuff. Then, oh, this is another packet on stream two, or I think they call it frame, right? Frame for stream one. So, oh, I have to merge this and this. So there's more CPU processing that you have to do to assemble these HTTP packets. So, da-da-da, so many questions. Good stuff. How can you study existing complex database quickly? You're immediately jumping to the complex databases. I mean, you have to learn the fundamentals first, right? The fundamentals of a database. Check out my Udemy course about the database engineering. And if you don't want to check out, I have so many videos. Members can access these videos as well on my channel. I have so many databases videos in general. Learn about the basics, learn about the fundamentals of databases in general, and slowly grab more concepts as you need them. Like the other day, there is this thing that's called Common Table Expression, CTE, right? I never knew CTE like 6 months ago, right? But I learned about it and said, oh, this thing is very useful. So I started learning about it. So to this day, I don't know everything. Complex databases and all that stuff. So take it easy and slowly stuff. Which one do you choose between Apache and Nginx? Apache versus Nginx. I mean, both of them are proxies and both of them are web servers. So there is a, I guess, doesn't really matter, but Nginx is have more features than Apache. Apache was built as a web server, I believe. Right? And then became a proxy. And like, there's like little tools to make it a proxy, but I don't think it has as much advanced Nginx features when it comes to proxy and load balancing. I don't believe that has. Apache is focused as a web server. So it depends what you're trying to do. Quick over gRPC. Am I understanding this correctly? Quick, is the protocol gRPC is the carrier framework, so to speak? So Adita asks, gRPC over quick over gRPC. Are you saying quick over gRPC or would you pick quick over gRPC? Well, this is a very different, in my opinion, right? gRPC is a framework that is a communication protocol that is set on top of HTTP2 that gives you bidirectional low-level control and schema-based objects, right, on top of protocol buffers, which I've been. Check out my gRPC video if you want to learn all about stuff, and check out the protocol buffer video there. So that's gRPC. So there's so much stuff you can do with gRPC. Quick is the protocol that allows you to multiplex multiple requests on top of UDP, essentially. And it has so much features, right? So I would compare Quick with HTTP2, not much with gRPC, because gRPC has so much features that Quick doesn't have, like protocol buffer, right? Quick is a transport protocol. gRPC is way application layer, right? So you can't really compare the two. So gRPC might be built in the future on top of Quick. I think it will. 100% that people will move gRPC on top of Quick instead of TP2. Hope that helps. Good questions coming. My questions. Kristen says, hey, I'm missing your courses on Udemy. What happened? So I removed, I privated, let's say, all my content on Udemy because of Udemy rules that don't make any sense. Don't worry, because this content is now available for free on YouTube. I made the Envoy and Traffic video available for you on YouTube. You can watch those videos. What you lost on YouTube is the ad free, right? Udemy, you purchased it once and you have it, right? And what you lost is other videos that kind of introduces the concept of traffic, right? Or like, what is HTTP? What is WebSocket? What is TCP? I talk about this stuff before starting the traffic course. But the problem is I wanted to do this and then move that course. I keep the course for a little while and then move it as free, because I want to, as much as possible, share this concept, because I want to move to something else, right? And reach as much people as possible. So I wanted to make the course for free. And Udemy wouldn't let me. Says, hey, this is an 11-hour course. You cannot make it for free. That's what? But I want to put it on YouTube, so I have to make it for free. So it says, okay, there's no solution for this, right? So it's very restrictive. And another stupid thing that I did with the stupid coupons, that you have to have only 30 days and 30 withdrawal with the coupon. So it's just so much. I'm moving, long story short, I'm moving my content to some other course. So I'm going to start a new course, a platform. Probably I'm going to use an existing one. I don't have time to build an existing one. So I'm going to use an existing one and just build on top of that. So that's the story with Udemy. So there's one course left in the introduction to database engineering. I might take that course off as well in 2021. What DB technologies that are you look up to in 2021? There are so many DBs. Now, Snowflake, was that DB? I forgot what's the name. Not Snowflake. I forgot what's the name. But essentially, databases, I forgot what it's called. I want to learn Spanner, Google Spanner. I want to read the Dynamo paper and make a video about the Dynamo paper, which obviously came from Amazon DynamoDB, which inspired Facebook Cassandra, right? And all that stuff. Nico says, how secure the NPM is? Can you catch security threat on NPM? Yeah, I made many videos on NPM. It's very, very fragile. It's a very, very problematic baggage manager. So people, I think some people commented like, good rule of thumb, never download an NPM package that is not at least 6 months old. That's the, because like people sneak in all sorts of garbage, make you mine for Bitcoin, or not Bitcoin, you cannot mine Bitcoin anymore. What's the other thing? Monero, whatever that thing is. Do you use SQL in graphical databases? Graph-based databases? I think it's a different language. I'm not sure. Muhammad Fathi, I really enjoyed your last video on indexing. I didn't quite understand the difference between bitmap and scan and heap scan and indexing. That's a good question. So I also explained that in my database engineering course, but let's talk about that. So we're almost going to end the screen. We're also going to end the stream, not scream. All right. We have, let's talk for 10 minutes and then end that screen. We'll get a few questions. We're going to stop in around, yeah, that time. So talk about that a little bit. Index only scan, bitmap scan. That's a little bit of Postgres terminology, but I think it's very useful. Let's talk about that a little bit. You have a table. You have a beautiful table here, right? And there is two indexes, two fields on this. Field A, let's say it's integer, and field B, which is also an integer. And there are like, I don't know, 3 million rows in this table. So A, B, table. Now you created an index on top of A field, the field A, right? And then you created another index on top of field B. Now there will be another data structure called A with all the index entries that points nicely to the rows, right? And there will be another index that's called B with all the... Cool. Now, if you say select from test the table where A is equal 7, the Postgres execution planner will look at the filter predicate and says, okay, you want to query field A for the value of 7. It will look at field A and says, oh, A has an index, which is yummy. So it will look at the index column and says, okay, let's query the index here. And it will start scanning the index, has to scan the index. So it's like, okay, and this is a B tree, right? So okay, 7, I'm looking for 7. We'll jump to the root of the index, and there is a value of, I don't know, 1, right? So, okay, is 7 greater than 1 or less than 1? Oh, it's greater than 1. So I have to go left. Then you found a value of 5. Oh, is 7 greater than 5 or less than 5? Oh, it's greater than 5. Let's just jump here. So based on this B tree structure, you immediately find the value of 7. And then with the once you find the value 7, now you have a pointer to the row in the heap table, which we described. So this 7 value, which is index, points to the row. And you just take that and immediately, oh, one value, right? Just you found one value and just jump it there. And if there's multiple values, it's going to do the same thing. It's going to start compiling these values. But let's say we found one value only. If we found one value, we're done, right? We have one value. That's it. I have to jump back to the row. Let's say row number 301, right? And we jump to 301, to the table itself. We pull that row and all its columns. So we have, let's say I have other columns and I have access to whatever I need. So that's it's called an index only scan, right? Not necessarily. This is an index scan. It's called just an index scan. So we scan the index and we jumped back to the heap table to pull the row, right? Sometimes the value will be in the index itself, and I talked about that, and it's called, let's say, if you asked for the same value, that's kind of dumb, but is going to be an index-only scam because the value that you asked for is in the index itself. So you say, okay, I don't need to jump to the table. That's even better. It's called an index-only scam. But no, this is not our topic. So I pick that and I jump back to the table and get the row. That's an index scam. So now, if I do the same thing on B, where B equal 8, I'll do the same thing and I find the value and jump back to the table. That's an index scam. Now, if I found multiple values in the index, right? Let's go back to 7. I'm scanning again the same index A. I'm looping through the index. I found 7. And then I continue. Oh, I found another 7. So the first 7 points to, let's say, row 301. Found another 7. Oh, that's row 601. And then I found another 7. Row 901. And so on. You start finding a lot of rows. What do you do? What do you do as a programmer, as a backend G? What would you do in this case? Would you, for example, the first value you found, do you jump to the row, to the table, and do a read? Right? And then go back to the index, scan again, and then go back to do a read? Because you found another 7, right? You have to go back to the row to fetch the whole row. Do you then go scan and then do jump, go back and jump, do back and jump? No, you never do that. That's just... The database might decide to do that if you have like 3 rows. It's like, okay, I can suffer through that. It's not bad, right? Because it's not as bad if you go 3 times. You have to do like 3 reads, right? So the database sometimes might decide, the Postgres execution plan will say, wait a second, this is dumb. We're finding a lot of values for this stuff. Wait a second. What should we do? Let's build a bitmap, which is a value, like a structure, like a bitwise structure, 64-bit. And we start setting the bits. This is going to be all zeros. Check out my Bloom filter video, so this makes well more sense. Bitwise operating and stuff like that. So it's like, okay, I found 601. Where's the value 601? Oh, boop, boop, boop. I set the value 601, right? And then go build another bitmap. Oh, this is a 901. Set the value. Another one. Set the value. So you start building that structure with all the rows that you need to read. And then once you finish the index, you do one jump to the table and read all these rows. Poof. One read. So you ask the controller, hey, give me row 601, 900, and 300. And so he's going to go and pull in multiple pages at the same I.O. So a single I.O. versus multiple ones. So that's a bitmap scan. So that's the difference between index scan and then bitmap scan. So technically, in bitmap scan, most of the time, it is an index. That's why it's called bitmap index scan. So it's built to scan, collect the bitmap, and then goes once. This could be a little bit expensive, right? Especially in 2 indexes, right? So the benefits of this is the ability to use multiple indexes. Let's take this example. I built a query that says A equals 7 and B is equal 3. So what are we going to do? We can spin up 2 threads or 2 processes to query the index A and index B. A looking for value 7 and B looking for value 3. And it started building the bitmap. So build your bitmap for A, build your bitmap for B, and then AND them, literally just AND them. And anything 1 and 0 is going to become 0. If it exists here and doesn't exist here, that's false, right? If it exists here and doesn't exist here, that's false. If it exists here and here, then it exists. That's an AND, right? So it's a very, very quick way to build a bitmap. I keep hitting the mic. Build bitmap and then union them, do an AND, and then with the value, the resulting result set of the bitmap is what you query the table to fetch. All right. So when I said bitmap scan are slower, I was talking about the ability to combine those 2 indexes into 1 index, right? And that's essentially the composite index, where we have one index that contains both A and B. That, in that case, you don't really need to do a bitmap if you have like one or two values, right? With the multiple indexes, you have to do a bitmap. You don't have a choice, right? Because you have to build a bitmap and then add them. Here, you just scan one index and all the values are there. So that's essentially, hope that helps. Let's sip some coffee. I didn't say what coffee today we had. Today we have a coffee from Colombia, I believe. I actually posted it in my Instagram. Let me check. What was it? It was San Carlos, today's coffee. Obviously not sponsored, but I like to show you what coffee I drink every week. I have a subscription with this company called Trade. They send me new coffee because I love coffee. If you follow me on Instagram, I try different kind of coffees, beans. So it's Heirloom Bourbon Washed Antigua from Guatemala. Sorry. San Carlos, Guatemala, coffee of the week. Welcome, Mahmoud. You're welcome, Mahmoud. Ahmed Khodair Hussein. I have function that write logs error in text file, right? But I do not know what will happen if some error come at the same time. How will function write in an open file? So when you open a text file, you have the ability to obtain a lock in that file so that other applications cannot write to that. Only you can. So essentially, it's a very similar concept to databases. Like it's an exclusive lock. You obtain a lock to the table, the file so that nobody else but you can write. So I don't understand why would you get an error to write to your own file that you open. You shouldn't, right? Unless your application spins up another thread that attempts to write to the same file from a different descriptor, right? So it's like it treats it as a different file. So once you understand how things work, it's not really that hard, right? So that's what happened essentially. So find out if your application is spinning up multiple processes and trying to write the same file. Some locks will prevent people from even to read. You can do that if you have low level control. Carlos, hello, my friend. How are you doing? Hey, folks. Hanin Muhammad, hello. Muhammad says, I got a feeling that you don't like Kubernetes. Oh, not really. I don't like Kubernetes. I just don't like people using technologies in general that they don't need, right? But Kubernetes is a great tech. I mean, back to the book I just showed you guys, right? There's the Zen of programming. If you treat the design, if you look at these designs, Kubernetes is a beautifully designed software. And you can look at this and appreciate the technology, and I love everything about it. I don't know much about it. That's my next step, is to educate myself about the container management systems, CNAMEs, Linux operating system, and jump to Kubernetes. I cannot jump to Kubernetes without not understanding how containers work, right? I just refuse to, essentially. So I'm on this. I have all the time in the world. I'm just gonna continue learning, right? Just gonna continue just jumping this. So it's gonna be a process. You're gonna start seeing videos about more videos on containers. You're gonna start seeing videos more about Kubernetes in the future, definitely. So yeah, I don't hate Kubernetes. I appreciate the architecture and design behind it. It's a beautiful design, beautiful application software. How do you think we can deploy real-time backends socket connected without downtime? Oh, that's a tough question, Ahmed. Tough question. So without downtime, you gotta be really regiment when it comes to reconnecting, right? If there's was downtime, right, is the ability to is clients will no longer be able to be served from the backend, right? So there could be a machine that just went down, or could be the machine can no longer handle the load. Whether this is a resource constraint or a bad design in the application itself, so that it does not scale. Right? Let's say you every request you make, you actually consume a little bit more resources, and you're doing a lot of synchronous processing that blocks future people from connecting. So this is a very tough question. Any videos on high-level design? Sure, we'll talk about that. You're welcome, Ahmed. Sir, you look sleepy. Of course, I always look sleepy. Because I wake up today, I wake up at 4:30 in the morning. Did my whole routine and stuff like that. Today's another episode on Haiku. I watched this anime called Haiku, the volleyball Japanese anime. So every Saturday, they air a new episode. So today, new episode. That's good. And guys, yeah, take time to enjoy yourself and do things that you like. Take a break and come back to the problem that you're facing, and you'll have more open mind. So I might look a little bit sleepy because I woke up a little bit. Like that's always like that in the morning. Have you tried Elixir? I have not, Darwin. What are you most important skills? What are the most important skills? Honing says. What are the most important skills you need to manage to become a good backend engineer? To become a better backend engineer. Any other type of engineer, in my opinion, is to grasp a handle on the fundamentals of backend engineering. Whether these are the networking, the basic networking concepts, the security concepts, communication protocols, proxies, and other stuff as well. So I talked about that in my video. But in general, if you understand the fundamentals, the first principles, any tool that comes on top of that, you will easily dismantle that tool into its basic first principle. It's like proving a mathematical equation, right? If I said, okay, prove that y is equal, f of x is equal y squared minus x squared, and that is equal to x minus y minus x multiplied by y plus x. How do you prove that, right? There are certain first principle in mathematics, yeah, you can go back and prove each one of them, and you can go back and prove everything back to the multiplication and addition, right? At the end, once you understand that, you can prove anything in the future, right? And that's the same thing with the backend. To become a good backend engineer, if I say Kafka, that's very confusing, right? But once you understand what Kafka does, oh, it's a pub sub, right, system, essentially, right? And Kafka do not like, the people in Kafka do not like if they, you say, oh, it's not just a pub sub system. We do all the other stuff as well. Of course, because you will be simplifying it too much. And that's kind of unfair. But to a nutshell, it's a distributed pub sub system, right? So you have a publisher and consumer, and then you publish content to this cluster, and there's a consumer that consumes. And then once you understand that, you will have more questions, because now the next step is how does the consumer actually consumes? Because a good backend engineer will actually ask these questions. Oh, well, how does Kafka consume compared to RabbitMQ? And that becomes really powerful, because now you start comparing technologies. But if you don't understand what Kafka is, how the heck are you going to compare it to RabbitMQ or ZeroMQ? It's impossible, because you don't understand how it works. So once we break down, you shake the architecture to its knees, you can understand everything, right? And you start not only understanding, you start criticism, English day, mercy. Criticizing. God damn it, I can't pronounce this yet. Criticizing. Sorry, English not good, my friends. What to do? My English very weak. Yes. My Russian is way better than my English. But my English is getting better with time. So I will get better, swear. Definitely will good. What I was talking about? Yeah. So you will start criticizing the technology itself. And that is badass. If you can get to a point where you criticize and get and you improve the technology itself, man, that is so powerful. That's so powerful. Because now it says, okay, why would Kafka use long polling in their consumer versus RabbitMQ where you use the push? And you can start asking, what is push? What is long polling? You start understanding this thing. And you start comparing. Same thing with the Postgres. Once you know how Postgres indexing works compared to MySQL, you will have full understanding to pick one technology over the other based, again, on your use case. There is no bad or good here. Everything can be really linked together. Ziz Thin is a man of class. He has hydro flask. What? That doesn't make me a man of class. Video is not sponsored by hydro flask, by the way. Jesus, I gotta say that every time? That's just dumb. All right. Solo wind hack explained. I kind of did, but I'll make a video about it. It's a badass. Those people, man. What other languages do you speak, Hassan? Carlos says, my main tongue is Arabic. My mom's tongue, Persian. Well, she was born in Bahrain, but she speaks Persian. She didn't teach us Persian or Farsi much, but I understand Farsi a little bit. And I obviously, we have to learn English when we are young. And I speak little tiny French from school and university. And I'm interested in Japanese, so because I watch anime, so Nihongo ga sukuchi wakarimasu. Not wakarimasu. Nihongo ga sukuchi hanashimasu. Why Microsoft backend is all .NET, why not Java or Go? I mean, they built .NET. Sandeep, they will use the .NET. But I think internally they use all this stuff. Like between themselves, like there are engineers that just use this. Persian means Iran, yes. The Persian language is the Iranian language. I think Persian is related to Macedonia. Yeah, of course. I don't know the history. Yerma, you're giving me history lesson. I don't know. Good stuff. Hussein, please make a video on what happens when you Google search from DNS. Hey, I did that. Suapita. Let's give you that. So what happened when you actually go to google.com and you hit enter? So you literally go to YouTube and say, what happens when you search Google? And the fourth result is mine video. And I want you guys to go and give it some love so it get pushed in the algorithm. Copio. Pesto des. Copy. Pesto des. Hamer Sharif is in town. My friend, how are you doing? Thank you so much. So, guys, if you don't know Muhammad Sharif, he's the one who encouraged me to do live streaming. So he had me on his podcast back in October 1st, October 3rd of this year. And he said, dude, you should really do a live stream. And I was so scared because I don't know how to work this thing up and how to work. And he showed me how, and he's just like, don't worry, just do it. It's so much fun. And you can have fun with some people for a couple of hours, and people really appreciate it. So he really pushed me to do it. And this is our 10th live stream. So thank you to Muhammad. So follow Muhammad for he is a security engineer in Okta. So any security question, I go to him. Any authentication question, all this stuff, I go to him. I don't know anything about security. But he's the guru, security guru. So yeah, so what I just pasted is the Google, what happened when you go to google.com and hit enter. Exactly in details. And most of the comments in that video is that are just people trolling me. So it's like, you need 40 minutes to explain that. Really? It's just go to Google and hit enter. You can explain that in 4 minutes. It's like, really? Well, I took 40 minutes because I suck. I'm sorry. Okay. You are great. Thanks for all the content, Alberto. Thank you. Greeting from Spain. Welcome to the channel. Glad you like the content. Appreciate you guys. This is good. Guys, by the way, would you be interested if I stream everywhere, like the use the StreamYard tool to stream, like on Twitter and Twitch and everywhere, or do you prefer just YouTube, right? Because I'm not sure about that thing. I like to kind of build a community, right? Are we stuck? No, we're not stuck. Oh, that was cool. So yeah, I'd like to build a community and then, like, a closed community with the YouTube people. So that's why I like to stream, like, in one location. But if you prefer on other location, let me know. Love your in-detail content. Also, greeting in Germany. I love this community. I love that we have people from Germany. You know, I still have memory from Germany because I went to Germany when I was 4 years old. And I still remember... Ahmed says stream in all things.
YouTube is fine. Stream on Twitter.
So yeah, I went to Germany. I believe. How do you send this thing? I when I was like 4 or maybe 6 years old, like my dad was studying there and he took us there. So it was like we were kids, and I still have memories of Germany, which is so funny. I say there are certain smells that reminds me of that area. Right, like the smell of there was like we lived in a mountainous area, so the smell of the grass. If I smell grass on the ground, I remember Germany, which is so funny. So beautiful, beautiful country. Wish I can go back. So Mohammed Sharif works on Okta. Yes, you know, guys, Okta. The authentication. All right, guys, I think we're gonna end the stream today. We'll be streaming for 2 hours. So let me know if you love this stuff. We're going to continue this theme of the Q&A. Sounds greato this. Very, I love this. And as I promised you guys, there are so many videos I need to make. First of all, I need to continue the report on... on Google, what happened to the Google outage, right? Because Google outage was a complete disaster. It was a disaster. It was so bad that it stopped for 40 minutes, right? So we need to know what was the main source of that. And they finally published a report, the detailed incidents of what exactly happened there. So as I was a quota management sign of thing, so I'm reading that. I'm gonna make a video of that. There is the solar wind disaster. It's a huge disaster, right? And we're gonna talk about that as well. So upcoming videos. So it's gonna take me a couple of weeks. There might not be videos in the weekend. There might not be videos on Monday. So because I'm gonna be focused full on making these videos. So it's gonna take me so. I apologize if there won't be no new videos this coming 2 days, but We have 500 videos to watch, though. I don't think there is a shortage of content. So take your time. And guys, that's it for us today. Let's end the stream here. And guys, I just want you to stay awesome. Keep on going. Yeah. Make sure to take time to kind of rewind, right? You're like, especially when you're coding, that's just like the most processing you. There is a lot of work. Relax and take time for yourself. Enjoy what you're doing. Do the thing that you like more. Then you're going to come back to the bug, to the design problem, to the back end challenge with a fresh set of. To look at the. All right, guys. Zay, thank you so much. Appreciate you. Thank you so much, everybody of you. Great questions as usual. And let's see, what should we title this stream? We talked about so much stuff. I wonder what I'm going to think about the title. We talked about so many other things, right? Aman, thank you so much, guys. Aman says, big fan. Thank you. Appreciate you. And I'm going to see you on the next one, guys. You guys stay awesome. Goodbye. And have a great, fantastic weekend. And keep those great, beautiful questions coming. Goodbye.